Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have a very special guest with us in mobile home park appraiser and mobile home park owner, Mr. Eric Hansen. Before we dive in, I want to ask you a real quick favor. Would you mind please taking an extra 30 seconds and head over to iTunes to rate this podcast with 5 stars? This helps us get more listeners, and it means the absolute world to me. Thank you so much for making my day with that 5-star review of the show. All right, let's dive in. Eric Hansen owns and operates manufactured housing communities in his home state of Wisconsin. He acquired his first community in 2021 and continues to expand his portfolio. Eric is also a real estate appraiser and holds the prestigious MAI designation from the Appraisal Institute. His career as an appraiser began back in 2001 with a variety of property types, and in 2012, he started specializing in RV park, campgrounds, and mobile home park properties. He joined Colliers Valuation and Advisory Services in 2023 and is a member of their Manufactured Housing Community Valuation Team. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me. Appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive in here. Would you mind starting out by telling us about your story and how in the world you got into appraising mobile home parks?
Yeah, so first of all, most people don't aspire to be appraisers when they're growing up. So my background, early age, grew up with an agricultural background. Didn't grow up on a farm, but worked on actually one of the largest poultry farms in the state of Wisconsin. So I did that growing up. And then when I graduated high school, I went to work for a large commercial construction company during my summer breaks from college. So that was kind of my first dive into commercial real estate. So this particular company was building schools and hospitals and hotels and a lot of really big projects. These were all in Wisconsin. So that's how I spent my summers. And like I said, got kind of acclimated to commercial real estate. So fast forward a couple of years, I was probably in my third year of college, met a real estate appraiser, and I guess the wheels kind of started turning that maybe this has some potential. So I met him actually in one of my real estate classes, and then I followed up with a phone conversation and had a meeting with him, and it ended up he brought me on to his appraisal company. So that particular company had a residential division and then a commercial division. So the commercial division was appraising all property types throughout Wisconsin and then some in Minnesota and Iowa, so kind of the tri-state region there. So I started out with typical stuff such as apartment buildings and office buildings, industrial, retail, a little bit of everything. So I had done that for a number of years, did additional training, appraisals and courses and things like that. And then I think it was around 2012, I started my own appraisal company. And at that time, started into mobile home parks, which was completely by accident. I didn't know much about them, probably just enough to be dangerous. I got a call from a lender that I had done a lot of work for on different property types. And they said, well, we have a buyer and a seller for a mobile home park in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is where I was living at the time. You want to take a stab at it? So that's kind of what got me started. And it was just coincidentally, the buyers on that were Frank and Dave. And I had no idea, of course, who they were.
Wow.
At the time. And the banker said, well, why don't you look these guys up and see who they are? So I started searching and wow, they're really, really into the business. So through that connection, Dave got me connected with the Mobile Home University website. And I started doing some of the chatting on the forum at the time, answering some appraisal related questions. And that's really kind of how I started building my network, mainly with people buying parks. I actually got acquainted with a very good friend of mine now, and he's kind of been my mentor through the Mobile Home University website. He was looking for an appraiser on a park in Nebraska. So we kind of started talking about that, and that deal fell through, but we ended up becoming really good friends. And he's acquired several parks over the years in the Midwest and Great Plains. And so it kind of got some relationships started there. And then lenders were on there too, looking for appraisers. I started a really cheesy website, mhpappraisal.com. And at that time was on the front page of Google when you search for mobile home park appraiser. So that got me a lot of traction. And now it's, you know, a lot of word of mouth. So did my own thing for a while, then teamed up with some other appraisers. That was more on a regional basis. So at that time I was basically upper Midwest and Great Plains. And then eventually I went to work for a national appraisal company and branched out even further. And now I'm with Colliers, and we, of course, have national coverage, actually international coverage. We do appraisals as a company all over the world, in mobile home parks and RV parks in North America and Australia and probably some other areas as well. So our team is probably about a dozen people that really specialize in those two asset classes. So, you know, we get asked kind of, who do you work for? That type of thing. A lot of the volume, of course, is lending work on the transaction side, but we also do a fair amount of private party work. An example of that would be we would do work for an attorney to settle an estate. They need an appraised value as of date of passing for the estate settlement, those type of things. So a lot of different clients, local banks, regional banks, a lot of agency work, life lenders. Do work for a lot of the large REITs, things like that, for their own valuation purposes. So kind of a wide variety.
That's interesting. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. A lot of demand, I'm sure, over the past couple of years. Let's go back to 2012, though. You know,
yeah.
I think the MHU forum was ingenious. I mean, that's such a great resource. We'll make sure to put a link for that in the show notes, but the MHU forum, there's just a ton of information on mobile home park investing questions, and you can get in there, and there's active operators, there's appraisers, there's lenders that are giving, you know, feedback. So that's a great resource for anyone interested in mobile home park investing, is that MHU forum. But how else did you get, you know, get educated on the asset class, specifically for mobile home parks back in 2012, like to learn about like what you needed to know from an appraisal standpoint?
So a lot of it was boots on the ground. So at that time, when I'm out inspecting a property for an appraisal, I'm driving all the parks in the area and talking to either managers or owners. And honestly, at that time, they were a lot more accessible than they are now with all the acquisitions that have gone on in the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. It's harder to get a hold of people. So that was one way. And then the original podcasts, you know, Jefferson Lilly had a podcast, and there were some other ones too. So listen to all those. Frank was doing some YouTube stuff. Some of the brokers were doing some YouTube stuff, and all that was kind of before Facebook really took off with all the different, I mean, I don't know how many groups I'm involved in now. There's a bunch of them that you can, you know, ask a question and get an answer pretty quickly on mobile home parks. So a lot of those different things. Went to Frank's boot camp in Minneapolis. I can't remember the year now, probably 17 or 18 when they were still doing the live in person. And that was just fantastic. I highly recommend it. And Frank Rolfe, if the listeners don't know who he is a wealth of information on mobile home parks. And when he says he's accessible to talk about deals, he really is. I've called him and he's on break from a meeting or boot camp, and he'll answer the phone and talk to you about a deal and tell you what he likes or doesn't like and things like that, which is really pretty
baffling.
Neat.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had the same experience. It's like he picks up the phone very often, you know, and every boot camp he's got at least 100 people in the room.
Yeah.
And, you know, think of all the students he's had, but he still picks up the phones. And I remember, I think there was like a weekly call on Wednesdays, like every week for an hour, he get on and does a live Q&A. And mm-hmm. I remember when I first got started, I just sat on those meetings and just was listening to all these questions and answers. And this was before I owned any parks. And it was just so educational. So I agree. Yeah, Frank definitely is, he's been on the podcast and he's coming back on soon. So excited to interview him again. Yeah.
So yeah, that was a great experience. And as part of that boot camp, I still stay in touch with several of the people I met there. Some have bought parks, some have not, but it's been great for building the relationships and just general learning. And
that's my very first equity partner, my very first investor I met at the first MHU boot camp I attended, way back in, I think it was 2016 or 2017. So yeah, definitely good networking.
And I don't know if they're doing those in person yet or not, but definitely recommend it, even if it's a virtual thing. It's a really good learning experience. But I would say overall, talking to different owners and operators has been by far the most beneficial. And
what do you ask them when you're talking to them? What do you want to know?
So here's the thing, and I've been doing a lot of reading in the last couple of years, and there's kind of a lot of themes that recur in a lot of these books I've been reading, and I'll give you some examples later. But one of them is when you're looking for mentors, how are you adding value to them? So as an appraiser, that's really easy, right? So I'm doing some appraising in this market and trying to get a handle on lot rents and things like that. I saw you own a park in that market. Let's have coffee or something and talk about that particular market. So it's really, really an easy sell. So they kind of get some upside on that. And then, okay, well, you're submetering water and sewer. How did that process work? Or how is that going? Those type of questions. So a lot of operational type questions. And I continue to do that when I'm doing appraisals on, the mobile home parks and RV parks, really dive into, how it's actually operating. So that's been a great learning tool. But yeah, definitely on the, working with a mentor, I wouldn't go and just say, hey, I need a mentor, somebody help me. I have something to offer them. Maybe it's the boots on ground. Running a park for them or something, or managing a property, who knows, but have something of value that they can use in exchange for their knowledge.
Great tip there. Great tip. Eric, how many mobile home park appraisals would you say you've completed? Just a ballpark number.
Well, so I've been appraising about 22 years. So I would guess the overall number of appraisals is probably somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000. And I would guess maybe half of those are mobile home parks and RV parks, something like that. So, maybe it's 800 or 1,000. I don't really keep track of it. I mean, it's available if I need it, but yeah. And so those are all the ones I've appraised. But then on top of that, when I'm driving the parks and driving the rent comps and driving parks that have sold, I mean, it's thousands of mobile home parks over the last 22 years. And I can still pretty much remember most of them that I've been through. If something eventually sells, I can kind of make a mental note. Yeah, I drove through that a few years ago and I kind of remember what was going on there. So yeah, and if I stop and talk to managers, there's some I see about once a year in certain markets I work in a lot, and you get more familiar and always exchange data with the managers.
Have you been part of their job?
I probably have, and I probably didn't know they were yours at the time. Because sometimes, they'll just say, "Well, somebody from out of town owns it. I'm the manager, and what can I help you with?" So that's kind of a cool thing. So yeah, I've been through a lot of properties, seen a lot of stuff, and all kind of adds to the.
Let's dissect that, right? Because I think you've been through thousands of mobile home parks. So what about that can you say, like, what have you learned from that? Like, what have you taken away that's like, hey, when I do my own mobile home park investing, these are the type of parks that I want for my own portfolio?
Yeah. So, and it's kind of morphed a little bit. When I got my first deal, it was, I need to get a park. Like, I've been looking forever. I looked at a lot of deals and it just didn't make sense or the location wasn't right. But now it's more, not even the size of the market, but more of the parameters, the single family housing size. It used to be 100,000, but I'd like to see 200 or 250,000 for median home price. The median income, is that over 50? Is it pushing 100? Where is that at? So those type of things. And then where are lot rents going in that market? Is that a really good market and everybody's in the 300s and it should be pushing 500? And I still see some of those markets. And we used to have, you know, a lot of $200 markets. Okay, we can get to 300. Now we see a lot of 300 markets getting to 500, 500 markets getting to 900. So they've really gone up. So what's the overall potential for those lot rents in that market based on let's things that about, are going on there?
Yeah, let's talk about that. So what things would be going on that would give you that inclination that, hey, lot rents are, you know, 300. We look at 10 comps. You know, there's the subject property and then all 10 of them are mom and pop owned, but the median house price is 350, right? So I guess what are the things that you're looking for that tell you, hey, lot rents are about to pop?
Similar size markets, especially in the upper Midwest. Go to Iowa, for example, there's a lot of areas that maybe there's a town of 5 or 10,000 people and you would look at similar size markets. Where are lot rents going in those markets? And are the economies kind of similar? And if they are, that probably tells you there's some room for growth there. But to your point, we still see a lot of mom and pops that just have not raised rents. And it's to the point where we talk a lot about, you know, acquiring a park with under market rents, which is fantastic. That's what everybody wants. But sometimes I look at it and say, maybe they could be too far under market. If you're market is 500 and that park is 150. That's great. But how long will it take you to get up to 500? And by that time, then the market is 800. So is it really that great of a deal? Maybe not. And is the lot rent 150 because that's what your tenant base is? Or it's just because mom and pop didn't raise the rents? And there's definitely a difference there.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. And I see those deals quite a bit, you know, like I have a deal right now, market lot rent should be 550. Mm-hmm. There's one operator in the market getting 550. That's a bigger, you know, REIT. And then all the other properties are mom and pop owned, including the one that, you know, we're looking at, you know, getting under contract, but all the other lot rents are closer to 295, 305 a month lot rents. And it's like, hey, you know, they're getting it, you know, and it's similar quality, you know, but I don't want to be the guy that comes in and raises rents $100 a month year one, right? Like, I don't want to end up on the front page of the newspaper. So there has to be something else, another story to be told, you know, CapEx wise, or, you know, just another way to add value besides just the rent increase.
Yeah. And that's a good question. We get that a lot. You know, what's the best way to add value? My number one thing is roads. That's just an obvious visual thing. The parks look so much better with a brand new road or newer roads that were just seal coated, just totally changes the perspective of the park. But then also, you know, what are the quality of the homes in that park? I've seen very, very nice senior parks that are 1970s homes, but they're all in fantastic condition. And then I've seen all ages park where they're 1970s homes and the park looks terrible because they weren't kept up. So, you know, it's important when we talk about lot rents, generally the larger operators, the REITs and those type of entities have the higher rents, but also they typically have the swimming pools and the basketball courts and they have some more amenities. They have professional management on site. They have a full-time maintenance person, full-time office people, usually multiple. So there's more to it than just being in that location. And generally, a lot of newer homes, things like that, newer roads. So those are things to look at too when you're looking at lot rent. But to your point, I don't think anybody really wants to be the market leader. But what's that gap between the market leader and what's historically been charged? And that's definitely a fine line. But if you're repaving roads or actually paving roads, you know, taking it from gravel to asphalt, I think that's a big value add. I think that takes you to the next rent level, whatever that is, if it's $50 higher or $100 higher.
Is that how you value it in your appraisals then? Or do you give them like, oh, that's a 100 basis points, you know, lower cap rate because they have new roads? Or, you know, how are you, you know, valuing from a valuation standpoint, you know, new blacktop?
It's a combination of all. So basically, how do we increase value? We either have higher income, lower expenses, or a combination of both. And then you also have your visual of the property. You know, what is the appeal of that property on top of higher rents, lower expenses? So if we're repaving the roads and rents go up, you know, let's say $50 in that first year, how is that going to affect the NOI, right? And also, how does that affect the maintenance? Because now we're not fixing potholes constantly because we have brand new roads. So there's a little bit, there's the income side, there's also the expense
side. You know, like to fix some potholes, okay, it's, you know, $3,500, you know, a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
To repave, you know, a whole property is $350,000, right? So like, I don't know, from an income and expense standpoint, it really adds up.
I think it could.
The appeal piece, I think, is a bigger, you know, it looks better, right?
Sure. And it's all, of course, going to, you know, how much can rents go up and how much is the cost of getting that rent up? So it's a mathematical thing like anything else in the analysis. And sometimes it just doesn't make sense. You see parks out in Wyoming, for example, one park has paved road, one park has dirt, not even gravel, just dirt, and they have the same lot rents. Well, yeah. If I own the park with dirt roads, why am I going to spend the money to pave when the lot rents are going to be exactly the same? So yeah. In that case, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So in other areas, it might.
Let's talk about this a little bit more here. So, you know, let's talk about like a cap rate premiums. What would you give public utility parks versus private utility parks in terms of like a premium on the cap rate from a valuation standpoint?
That answer has probably changed over the last few years, because it used to be everybody wanted public utilities, right? And we still do to an extent, but a lot of those parks were acquired and now a lot of private utilities. Sometimes there's no difference. We see a lot of parks in Ohio, for example, that have the packaging plants on site that sell at a six cap. And then the park with public utilities sells at a six cap. So there's really no difference. And generally, it's hard to narrow down to one specific thing on that cap rate. Is it just because of the utilities, or is it the age of the homes? Is it new roads in one versus the other? Is that location maybe a little bit better because it's closer to the school or Walmart or the manufacturing facility? And overall, it's usually not just one factor. So long-winded answer, it depends. But if all other things
like
are
an
equal...
Attorney. Let's
yeah,
say, you know,
yeah.
It was your own portfolio, just a gut feeling, you know, you're looking at two identical parks, one's public, one's private. You know, what would you give the premium for the public utility park?
You know, I think a reasonable range is probably 50 to 100 basis points. Another side of the equation that I've experienced personally, in certain states, you can bill back water and sewer on private utilities without sub-metering, basically a flat fee based on what local municipalities charge for water sewer. So then you look at it, and I don't want to say it's a profit center, but you're making more than you're spending on your water and sewer income. Now, of course, you're pumping septics and, you know, eventually replacing a well or a septic and things like that. But purely the income and expenses, the income side is higher there. Now, municipal water and sewer, when you submeter and bill back, usually not 100% collection. You have leaks, you have people move out and don't pay their bill and things like that. So you have that little bit of slippage there. So different ways to look at it a little bit, but all other things equal, you know, cap rates can be a little bit lower for municipal utilities.
Let's talk about direct build public utilities versus just regular public submetered utilities. You know, what would you know, all things the same, what would the premium be for a direct build public, you know, water sewer system versus just a submetered public water sewer system?
Yeah, that drops the cap rate even lower in most cases, you know, maybe another 50 to 100 basis points. And you know, obviously there's other factors involved there, but that's kind of the premium direct build, right? Okay. Generally, the cities are maintaining part of those lines or all those lines too, and things like that. And a lot of times you have publicly maintained streets in the park too, on top of that. So it's even more of a cost savings for maintenance and snow plowing and things like that. So it's that's kind of the premium, which doesn't exist in a lot of markets, but yeah, that's the best case scenario. And I get this question all the time about cap rates, and you know, a lot of times it's area specific, but it's more investor specific too. You know, what's your cost of capital? What do you see the upside? You know, are you buying it as is, and that's a four cap because there's opportunity to infill and rents are below market, and there's just a ton of upside. So does that four cap as is, does that really matter? We're looking more at year one, once we've owned it, what the property's doing, where does that come out? So it's sort of a loaded question, right?
Yeah, and there's not a cap rate for sure. Yeah, totally yeah. Agree with you there. What don't we know as mobile home park investors, right? Active owner operators, what don't we know about the mobile home park appraisal process that, you know, we should know?
Okay, so that's a really good question. A lot of that comes on the lending side. For the most part, you can't go to your lender and say, I want Eric or I want Colliers to do our appraisal, right? They have an approved appraiser list, and some are much more sophisticated. For the most part, the lenders that are very active in the space use appraisers that are familiar with the specific property types overall. What we tend to see is it tends to be more local lenders that want to get into the mobile home park space. Maybe they're going to give you a little break on the interest rate, but they're still going to use your local appraiser, right? And you've run into that. I saw your YouTube video on, you know, you kind of just went through a terrible experience, right? Because they just probably weren't as competent as some others.
Small town, yeah. In that scenario, it was a small town bank, doesn't do, you know, a lot of mobile home park loans, was kind of, you know, doing this deal because we're sophisticated operators and that made them comfortable with it. But they used a small town, you know, local appraiser that appraised it at a 12 cap on actuals for this mobile home park that it was a smaller one. I think it was like 34 lots, you know, but it was all public utilities, submetered at a 12 cap on actuals. And so the deal didn't appraise to the purchase price and it became this messy situation. And yeah, that's just a bummer, right? And it can mess up a lot of deals. So I think it's super valuable to go with someone that knows the asset class specifically.
Yeah, and there's more and more lenders now that are involved in the asset class than there was 5 years ago and definitely 10 years ago. Definitely worth reaching out if you know other operators in those markets or even in those states. You know, who's lending in South Dakota or pick another state, right? And generally, somebody knows a lender that's involved in that market and can get you on the right track there. So,
yeah. No, that's good.
But yeah, we hear that often, and it's an unfortunate part of the business that happens.
Yeah. What essential steps do you take? I mean, we talked about driving through the comps earlier, but what other like essential steps do you take when evaluating a mobile home park? Like what specifically do you need to look at to be able to come up with that valuation? Obviously, income, like we talked about earlier, is a big part of that, but what else plays into that?
Yeah, the rent roll. Where are things at on the rent roll? Obviously, try to verify the rent roll with what's actually on site. And a lot of times there's discrepancies there. Well, somebody maybe just moved out. Maybe that rent roll is a little dated, so it doesn't quite show what's actually there. Profit and loss statements going back a couple years. Property survey, see where the boundaries are. That can be important in situations where maybe you have an older park and some of the homes are not within the right setbacks, or maybe they're encroaching on a neighbor's property. And I ran into a Fannie Mae deal where the homes were actually on the neighbor's property. So we got to figure out how to solve that. Well, it's going to take actually moving the homes back onto the correct property. So there's some cost involved there that we got to consider. So things like that are important. And you know, some of the records we get are really sophisticated and others are, you know, drawn on a piece of yellow paper. So when that happens, we base it on what is the market going to pay for insurance, you know, an on-site manager, maintenance, what's the typical maintenance cost per site, things like that. And I know a lot of people analyze deals and they'll run a percentage of effective gross income, right? And say, well, I'm going to use 30% and analyze my deal real quick. those are a little bit outdated now with where lot rents have gone and where expenses are gone. So I always advise manually underwrite it with your insurance costs and what you think maintenance will realistically be, things like that, what you think utilities will realistically be, those sort of things. So, you know, like I said, we've seen all kinds of really good and really bad, and we try to reconcile it to the best of our ability. And then we also talk to the potential buyer. What do you think you're going to do with the property? And some of those are way, way out of line, and some of them are pretty realistic. So again, we have to reconcile that. How many homes can you realistically infill in the next year? And in the upper Midwest, you lose probably 4 to 5 months with the winter season, right? So let's take a real view at this. And those tend to be the more difficult properties to appraise. We have some infill, we have below market rents. Where is this actually going to go in year one and year two? How long is it going to take to get what we call stabilized? You know, 95% occupancy and at market rents and things like that. Those tend to be the more difficult ones.
Because that's a really important point, you know. So this is something you can typically pay a little bit more for, but there's an as-is appraised value, and then there's a stabilized value that you can typically pay. I think it's like usually, I don't know, around $500 more to get the as-stabilized value. And then I've been able to work with some of these, you know, local banks to say, hey, you know, because we're buying value add deals from those mom and pops that are putting their P&L on a yellow pad of paper, and their rent roll has this, you know, is a ledger, right? This written ledger that they're giving you. So on those types of deals, you know, they don't look good year one, right? Because there's $200 a month lot rents in a $500 a month market, and you know that's 70% occupied. So what we've been able to do is get the as is and the stabilized values, and then show a bank, you know, hey, can you loan us the money based off of the stabilized value, because this is what we're going to do, you know, year one. Is that what you're seeing other operators do as well with those two valuations?
Yeah, absolutely. So an important thing to talk about, the as is value, that is always required. That's federal standards, regulations we have to follow. But yeah, we get a lot of requests for stabilized value, and that may be as simple as getting it to market lot rent. You're at 300 and market's 350 and you're going to that in year one. So in a year it's at 350, here's the value. Other scenarios, much more complicated with infill and several bumps in rent and some infrastructure issues and CapEx and things like that. So some can get quite complex. And, you know, of course, the farther we get out in the future, the harder it is to project where the market's going to be at.
Totally. Yeah. And we've seen it where, like, the local banks will say, okay, well, we'll give you 75% of the, you know, as stabilized value, but you got to put, you know, $500,000 in this escrow account, and we'll release that money to you, you know, based on invoices showing you did X, Y, and Z improvements. But that's a great way for those looking to do value add deals and, you know, get some additional leverage there. Eric, tell me about Park owned homes and the income they create, you know, and how you consider those in your appraisal.
Most of the time we don't value Park owned homes. Most lenders don't want those included. So what we do is we will allocate out the site rent from the total rent. So for example, if the total rent your tenant is paying is $800 and site rent is $400, we bring that $400 out and we run that as a lot rent scenario. So basically we're valuing the park, just the real estate, based on site rent only. So that's the simplest answer. You get into some different scenarios where sometimes the park-owned home rent is so low, it's barely above the lot rent. So then you have some different situations there. But that's the simplest way. So we look at all the occupied sites, whether or not they have a park-owned or tenant-owned, and that's how we come up with our lot rent and run the valuation that way.
Gotcha. What can mobile home park owners do to add the most value to their properties right before a refi appraisal? Or just a refi or a sale event? You know, you mentioned roads earlier. You know, what other things have you seen operators do that you're like, okay, that is going to increase the value of this property, you know, XYZ?
Getting the financials in order, painting a clear picture of what has happened and what we project to happen or they project to happen. So on the turnaround, if you've spent the last 2 years dumping a ton of money in for CapEx and all these different things, lay that out. Well, yeah, maintenance was 100,000, but really 90,000 of that was fixing water lines or something like that. So explain why those historic or financials aren't really all that great to use in the analysis. And then, of course, you know, higher lot rents are obviously driving value. We see often a bump in rent increase right before a sale. That obviously helps the value there, things like that. So, but I would say financials in order is a big thing. And there are smaller things, you know, new signage, fences, just general cleanup. That, but that's all kind of part of the rehab process. So a lot of those things are being done anyway.
Yeah. And other things like off-street parking, is that, you know, a premium, you know, curb and gutters, you know, how do you give a premium to a property that has those amenities versus a property that doesn't? Is it just strictly compared to the comparables in the area?
Yeah. So a lot of that, like if they don't have off-street parking, that should be reflective in the rents they're receiving. That property should not have as high a rents as property with two off-street
parking
spaces.
In a perfect market.
Right.
In a perfect market, that'd be the case. But with the majority of these properties being owned by mom and pops, that's just not the case, Eric. I'm sure you've seen it as well as I have.
Right.
Like so, you said, so those properties in Wyoming, I mean, I'm seeing that in a lot of other states, like all the states that we own, which is like 12, where one has gravel roads, one has fully paved roads with curbs and gutters, and they're both getting $500 a month lot rents.
Yeah, so in that case, it doesn't really, we don't have enough evidence to suggest it makes a difference to have off-street versus on-street. And sometimes that's just what the market is. It doesn't really make sense, but that's kind of what happens.
Yeah. What's been the most challenging mobile home park property you've evaluated during your appraisal career, and why?
Oh, wow. I don't know if I have one specifically. I would go back to the properties that have a significant amount of CapEx required. Some of the older parks that have vacant sites, are they amendable to modern homes? Can we actually get a 3-bedroom, 2-bath in there? Or do we have to put a smaller home? Or can we even get a home in some of those smaller sites? So is it really 90 sites or is it 70 sites now with today's homes and setbacks and things like that? And you can get into zoning issues and, you know, some areas require you to be modern setbacks when you infill homes. So now we have a whole different set of issues to deal with. So those are some of the things there to look at.
Two more appraiser questions. Number one, what are like some of the top mistakes that mobile home park appraisers make? And, you know, as community owners, how can we like make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, we never make mistakes. It's usually a lack of data. And I sort of say that joking, but not really. A lot of times it's just stuff we don't know. We don't know, you know, that you have 10 homes coming in next week unless you tell us that, right? Mm-hmm. Or and that's a, you know, pretty, you know, generic example. But things like that we don't know, you just replaced the water lines. We're going to ask the question. But if the manager doesn't know or somebody in the process doesn't know, we have no way to know that. So a lot of it is things that we just don't have the knowledge of. So we, of course, ask a sort of our due diligence. Here's all the things we'd like to know about the property, if possible, to make a better informed analysis of it. So same as on the buying side, but probably not as intense.
Gotcha. And then the last appraiser question is, you know, we bought about 50 commercial properties, some self-storage, some mobile home parks. And I'd say on about 40 of them, the appraised value comes back at the purchase price. You know, and it seems like a common thing. You know, why do you think that is? Is it more common, you know, that happens in commercial versus residential, or it just seems odd? Do you guys get the purchase contract?
We always request it. We don't always get it. And then sometimes it's amended afterwards, of course. There's no good answer to that. Some appraisers, they're just shooting for that number. And that number seems to make sense. I see a lot of deals that are worth well above what the purchase price is. Tends to be most of those are off market. Some on market though, they just, somebody missed something along the way, and this guy figured out what's going on in that market that somebody else didn't. So there's just some deals to be had. Now, you know, to be fair, most lenders are only going to lend on, you know, the lower of the purchase price or the appraised value. So, you know, sure, even if you got a screaming deal on it, doesn't necessarily matter for the loan part of it at purchase. Matters probably more on the refinance part, you know, a year or two down the road, mm-hmm, based on what lenders have told me over the years.
Yeah, that makes sense. Tell us about your portfolio, Eric, of like the mobile home parks that you own.
Yeah, so I've got two parks in Wisconsin. First one I bought in 2021. That park was actually listed locally in MLS and never made it to, you know, LoopNet and CoStar and those different, you know, subscription services. So that one is 31 sites. We have 26 active sites, private utilities. At the time I bought it, it was half long-term RVs and half mobile homes. So we ran into some zoning issues initially. I had conversations with the county about the use before I bought it. And my plan was to make it all mobile homes eventually. And they were on board with that. And the comment was also made that, well, if that plan changes, we'll work with you on zoning or conditional use, things like that. And then about a month into ownership, I got a letter that I have 28 days to remove all the RVs or, you know, going to be a big trouble. So I had additional conversations with the county about the plan and the process and things like that. So it's been a turnaround project, replaced a septic, replaced, or I should say actually put in new electrical lines for 8 sites, brought in several homes. We had several organic move-ins, which was awesome. That's where, you know, tenants bring their own homes in from different communities for different reasons. A lot of that was family-oriented, which was awesome. So one of the things we did on that park, which was really neat, has worked well, is we basically said anyone bringing in a home, even if it's a little bit older, we want new skirting, new siding, new roof, new windows. Want the outside to look good. Clean up the community. We'll give you, you know, let's say 12 months to do that. And then whatever the inside looks like, it looks like. That's, you know, as long as it's habitable, we don't necessarily worry about that. So do whatever you want there. And everybody that is in the park now has followed that. We have a few legacy tenants that we'll have to have that conversation down the road. So that's one thing that really helped clean up the park. And that was, that park actually had, the roads were only a year old at the time of purchase. So that was a big attraction. And down the road, we found out we may be able to connect to municipal water and sewer. There's going to be a road project coming through in about 2 years. They're going to widen the highway, and highly probable they'll run water and sewer and cable lines along with the new highway. So there's some opportunity for some upside there. Yeah. So yeah, it's been a major turnaround project, but we've got better residents, we've got better homes. It's been a real learning experience. I never would have expected all that for the first park. So yeah, haven't necessarily fantastic. Had any cash flow from it yet, but it's been a great learning experience and done a little bit of everything there and experienced a lot of different things that, you know, hopefully make me a better operator going forward.
That's so cool. That is awesome. We are running out of time a little bit, and I have a bunch of questions here. You mind if we do kind of like a lightning round, and we just kind of, you just spit out the answer and we'll just go right to the next one real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. What do you think is the toughest hurdle to overcome in mobile home park ownership?
Buying the first deal. Absolutely. Signing your name on that first contract. That's step one. And then getting that to closing. I've had some deals I've locked up and then they didn't work out for different reasons. But that first one was really hard to
just the analysis, to get to closing. Paralysis and kind of the nervousness of
it, you know, is The title company on that first one. I'm like shaking. Like, is this really happening? You know, this is such a cool experience, but it's nerve wracking. But then, you know, once you get that first one, it goes a lot smoother.
Yeah. What do you feel is the best strategy, like investing strategy, in the marketplace right now for mobile home park investing?
I would say try to cluster in a certain geographic area. That seems to be the trend. And as I'm in the business, I like that idea. And I've talked to local owners, not necessarily saying sell me your park, but I'm an owner in this market. You know, if I can help you with anything, with contractors, things like that. And, you know, don't put it out there that, you know, I just want to buy your park, but, you know, just I'm here and, you know, we're looking at additional deals. And, you know, if that time ever comes, let's have that conversation. So that's been a real positive there.
That's awesome. What mistakes have you made, you know, with your mobile home park investing that you think we can learn from?
I've been way too lenient on late payers. I fell for some of the sob stories because life happens to everybody, right? And some of it's legit and a lot of it's not. And you figure out pretty quickly whose stories aren't legit. And then those people just need to find someplace else to live.
Yeah. Like, if you were going to invest passively as a limited partner into like a mobile home park fund or an individual syndication deal, what are the most important things you would want to look at as a passive investor?
Quality of the operator. One of your previous podcasts, and I can't remember who it was, said, you know, it's important to me that operator is actually operating the parks. It's not third party management. And that's a huge thing. And then how about you give me a list of, you know, the parks you own, starting with the first one you bought. Maybe I'm going to drive through a few of those and just kind of look and see what kind of operations you're running. One of your turnaround parks, what's that look like now that we're in year three? Where have you gone with that to get more of a comfort level?
That's a great, great golden nugget right there. What have you seen? You know, you said you've been through thousands of parks with third-party managed mobile home parks. Would you say you've noticed, you know, anything different about those parks versus ones where they're like owner managed?
I would say, you know, obviously they're not financially invested in the deal. So maybe they're not as motivated to, you know, get that new tenant in or get that home set up as fast as possible. Things like that. And no one's specific. And I understand the need for third party. There's some people that just want to be completely hands off. So there's definitely a need for that, but there's certainly not a lot of people in the mobile home park space that do that. And certainly not up to the level of apartments and different asset classes like that.
Totally. Totally. One thing that I had written down here, Fannie and Freddie, we're talking about like agency debt. When they hire you to do an appraisal, you know, what are some of the quirks that they bring to a deal, you know, if you wouldn't mind sharing? I think that would be
And they have their different requirements on park-owned homes and no tongues on the front of homes and things like that. Mm-hmm. But they are extremely thorough in their underwriting. So they question everything. So as an operator, you need to be prepared to explain every dollar and cent that's coming in and going out. And as appraisers, they expect us to do the same thing too. So if there's some ups and downs in income, it's not simply where we can say, well, we'll take the average of the last 3 years for insurance. Why was it higher in 2022? Well, we had a fire in the clubhouse. Okay, now I know that. Now I can put that in the report that was an unusual year for that expense or things like that. And same on the income side. So there's some different things there. So definitely some hurdles to jump through as an operator and as an appraiser. But certainly some attractive financing terms if you have a park that fits their criteria.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's been quirks, you know, on the parks that we've gone through agency financing on, you know, where they're doing these engineering reports and requiring repairs after the refi closing for, you know, sidewalks that have a little bump in them. They want to make sure that those are flattened out and, you know, road repairs and oil and gas leases that were found. And nobody, you know, we had to like go back and find like, you know, the oil and gas lease had been sold to three different owners and we had to go and get them to sign off on an affidavit. So you really got to have your ducks in order, you know, before you go down there. And, you know, definitely recommend an Alta survey. We found, you know, through going through this process, like gas lines that went underneath of some mobile homes that they wouldn't do the loan until we got those fixed. So there's definitely some, you know, stringent requirements there. So thanks for touching on that. Eric, yeah. what does the perfect mobile home park look like in your eyes and why?
I would say 50 or more sites, direct build, city-owned and maintained streets from an expense standpoint. Other than that, more market-oriented, like we talked about, single-family home prices, where's the opportunity for lot rents to go there? What's the demand in certain markets? On my two parks, just a quick example, I ran one Facebook Marketplace ad once, and I got 50 responses in 2 days. So I pulled the ad, and I haven't advertised since. Like, that's awesome, right? That you have such demand there that the park kind of sells itself and the market kind of sells itself. So I'd be leaning more towards the market. And my own experience with what I've gone through on the turnaround park, not that I can fix anything, but I can tackle a lot of things that 2 years ago I had no idea what I was doing, you know, infill and utilities and things like that. So a lot of things can be, you know, fixed, but that location, can't really do much about that.
That's a good point. What do you think is the biggest threat to mobile home park investing?
Rent control. We see some rents getting really high in some markets, and some are justified with the CapEx that's being done. Others, it's like, you just raised rents $300 in year one. Maybe that market supports it, right? Is that the right thing to do? And that's kind of the gray area. And I think rent control creeps in when those things start to happen. Every market's a little bit different. Every state's a little bit different with their regulations and things like that. But there's definitely more chatter in different states about the rent controls. And then that kind of changes everything. So I think we all need to be a little cautious about where things are going and what we're doing to improve those properties to justify what we're going to do on the rental side.
Totally. Yeah, totally agree with you there, because rent control is not the answer. It never is the answer. Look at the statistics. It doesn't work. But, you know, it's just a couple of bad operators that can give the entire industry a black eye. Yeah. Eric, we've covered so much today. Thank you so much for coming on the show. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, what would be the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, find me on LinkedIn. I'm readily available on there, and shoot me a direct message, or my email and phone number's on there, so I don't have to give it right now. But yeah, LinkedIn is kind of my thing now, and I'm on there almost daily, sometimes multiple times a day, and checking out RV park stuff and mobile home park stuff, and like to talk to operators and investors and seeing what's going on out there.
Awesome. I'll make sure to put the link to your LinkedIn page in the show notes so you can find that there. Eric, what's one last bit of important advice you would give an interested passive mobile home park investor before we sign off?
Yeah, I would say whatever asset class you're going to be investing in, be comfortable with it. Even if you're investing with an experienced operator, you still need to be comfortable with that asset class and know a little bit about what's going on there.
Definitely. Yeah, get educated, understand enough to make a good decision. It's great advice.
And there's really no excuse not to be educated now. There's so many resources, most of them, you know, no cost, to learn about mobile home parks, RV parks, or any asset class. So there's really no excuse to not know what's happening.
Agreed. Well, thanks again, Eric, for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's been great. I really appreciate the opportunity and look forward to talking to you down the road.
Same here. That's it for today, folks. Remember, please leave a review if you got value out of this show. I really appreciate it, as that helps us get more listeners. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.